Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New Books in History, a channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Hans Wagenberg, a historian of Japan at Penn State. Today, we'll be talking to Jeff Hayton about his book, Culture from the Slums, Punk Rock in East and West Germany, which came out with Oxford this year in March 2022. With me today is also Dr. Mahon Murphy in Kyoto University, a historian of modern Germany, who has been researching with me our own punk book that is focused on the scene in Kyoto, Japan. Now, Culture from the Slums is a cultural history of punk in Germany. The manuscript tracks the advent and growth of punk in divided Germany during the 1970s and 1980s, and the social and political response to the subculture. These decades witnessed an explosion of alternative cultures across divided Germany, and punk was a critical constituent of this moment. For young Germans at the time, punk appealed to those gravitating towards individual and cultural experimentation rooted in notions of ethnicity. And those consisted to be more real and genuine. Punk, however, was a foreign input, and the way Germans in both East and West adapted it to their own local needs, and a diversion yet surprisingly connected history of punk in both Germanies, tell us much about German history and society in the 1980s. Culture from the Slums makes two broad claims. First, Hayton argues punk was a medium for alternative living and a motor for social change. Much more than simply a waypoint on the narrative of progress that supposedly led from 1968 towards unification and beyond, it was an important social and musical movement. Second, through a comparative analysis of the subculture in East Germany and West Germany, Hayton argues that punk helps explain why West Germany flourished and why East Germany collapsed. Punk by the 80s ceased to function as an instrument of the difference in the West as it entered the mainstream. But the German Democratic Republic never was able to control punk. Hayton examines the roles which punk played in German politics, society, and culture, and how German context transformed punk. Put differently, this is a study about punk in Germany and Germany in punk. Culture from the Slums suggests the ideas, practices, and communities which came out of punk transforms both German societies along more diverse and ultimately democratic lines. The book is an important contribution to the growing scholarship of punk, which so far has been overwhelmingly focused on Anglo-American developments. So, Mahon, maybe you want to take the first question?
Okay, Jeff, thanks very much for spending time to talk to us today. We'll start off with the very simple questions, but what brought you to the story? I mean, why punk apart from any other musical genre, and why Germany in this period? Maybe if you tell us a little something about more about your background as well to help us fill in kind of your interest and in how you came to this topic.
Yeah, sure. Thanks so much for having me, guys, just for starters. And thanks for the resume of the book, Ron. So I've been interested, I guess, in music and German history for a while. Used to play guitar poorly. Played in a bunch of bands growing up, and then got interested in German history when I first started university. And so, thinking of marrying my interests, I wanted to use music, which is, I think, so filled with the production of meaning and contestation, as a vehicle for studying German history. But I didn't want to, I guess, write, I suppose, a sort of typical music history, or I guess I should say more popular music history. In other words, I didn't want to write, you know, a book about boys and bands, basically. I wanted to be able to use music to explore politics, society, culture, etc. Right. So my focus, I'm a German historian. My focus, I hope that I achieved this, was trying to elucidate how, in this case, punk was this vehicle for German history. And I was attracted to this moment in the kind of late 1970s, especially, and that's of course what brought me to punk. I'm not necessarily a punk fan per se. I like lots of punk music, but I like lots of other, you know, type of music as well. But what brought me to this moment in the 1970s is that this was a period, I think, and this is what I argue in the book, was very conducive to challenging kind of normative concerns. In this kind of post-60s period in which a lot of the status quo in both East and West was put into question. And so this seemed like a really, and, you know, I think it's evidenced by all the growth of the kind of alternative culture movements which emerge in this period, that this was a moment in which all sorts of future potentialities had opportunities to be pursued and some realized. Not all, but some. And I think that punk was a really important part of this. And so that's sort of what I was, what brought me to this this topic, and what I hope that I kind of accomplished with it.
Thanks. I want to start, if I can just jump in. I want to start with your title, right? Which is pretty intriguing. Right, you call a title "Culture from the Slums." It comes from 1978. I mean, the book you write about it comes from 1978. Title of an article in Der Spiegel, which the title is "Punk Culture from the Slums: Brutal and Ugly." I try not to mess up the German. "Punk Kultur aus den Slums: Brutal und Hässlich." Could you tell me more about the title? I mean, I was really intrigued. It's a great title, and maybe what does it say about the meaning of punk in Germany in 1978? This particular historical moment.
Yeah, I kind of went back and forth on this title a little bit, and I'll explain why. In the first place, I think that, so for starters, slums, I think, are very interesting to think about. And what they mean, how they are constructed, deployed. And here I mean less sort of physically as more mentally. And because there's all sorts of connotations which are, of course, associated with slums, margins, marginality, borders, specific spaces, inequalities, etc. And so that's, you know, on the one hand, that's what Der Spiegel is playing on. And this was an article that appeared in early 1978 that was very famous article within the punk scene, and I guess a bit more broadly. It's hard to kind of track how much of an impact that had, but certainly within the punk scene, this was a quite provocative article that resonated with the subculture, because here was Der Spiegel, which is, you know, a liberal magazine, you know, huge publication in Germany, that was trying to make sense of what was happening, or had happened, I guess, in Britain, because by 1978, punk is a little bit over in Britain, or at least the first wave is over. And in the article, they were talking about how it is, punk that is sort of about to arrive in Germany. And this, you know, this article and its kind of connotations, this is sort of this long tradition of commenting on Anglo-American culture coming to the continent, and plays up all sorts of older references like jazz and rock and roll. But what's really interesting is that some of the protagonists who I talked to in the course of this project, they repeatedly, this is multiple people who, you know, I didn't, had no contact with one another. Multiple people, when I told them that this was going to be the title, immediately said that there was no slums in Germany. And yet here, of course, Der Spiegel is mobilizing this term. And whether or not there are slums in Germany, I think that's up for debate. But nonetheless, there's this whole host of connotations. And punks, too, sort of gravitated to this idea of marginality. And this is, I think, an important through line throughout the book, which sort of speaks to, on the one hand, their consciousness of what they were trying to do. So their intervention in society. And it also speaks to, I suppose, the malleability of culture and the ways in which sort of foreign or imported traces can be, I guess, repurposed for a variety of different reasons. So this article, this title, I think speaks to this sort of incredibly complex intersection, which was taking place at the end of the 1970s in Germany as punk is arriving, even though, as I said, in Britain, it's maybe already gone by this time. Although that, of course, is also up for a lot of debate.
Yeah, punk was dead on arrival for many people, yet he never actually died.
Yeah, let's not...
Yeah, in slums, of course, it's... sorry, Mohan.
Let's not get into a long debate about how alive or dead punk is, but you make an interesting point just there. I also think about this idea you talk in your book about how some of the people you talk to, especially the original participants, who are very few, but of course, punk becomes then this part of kind of a social milieu, as you say in the book. And can you tell us a bit about the mass appeal of punk? I mean, it's already been discussed in Der Spiegel in 1978, but as it goes through the 80s, of course, becomes much more, very much ingrained in German popular music culture. So how does this kind of mass appeal of punk interact with the very sticky issue of authenticity that the original punks are talking about? And maybe the use of singing in the German language or something is an important point here.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing that I sort of encountered very early on, because of course, you know, I'm coming at this project from 30, 40 years later. And so sort of echo of what had happened originally in the late 70s has grown to a very outsized influence or impact compared to what was happening at the time. As you say, Mahone, there was a very, very small number of people involved in both East and West. It's difficult, of course, to pinpoint exactly how many people we're talking about. It depends on, you know, what you sort of qualify or define as being part of the subculture. But the impact which punk has had at the time and then later, just by looking at the Spiegel article, has been much, much bigger than sort of raw numbers. And that sort of, you know, mass appeal is really interesting because it sort of speaks to this kind of past moment in which people who, you know, weren't involved in any sort of form at the time could look back and say, yes, this was a part of my history and is a part of my identity. And I think, and this is what you were referencing, Mahone, is the idea of singing in German, I think, is an important part here. Punks in the late 1970s were some of the first bands to start singing their lyrics in German. Since the Second World War, German in popular music mostly, I'll qualify that for a second, but mostly had sang in English. This was kind of a repudiation of the perceived nationalism of the German language, at least initially. And then later on, certainly in the 60s, this was part of this transnational youth culture. Was to sing in English and to associate German popular music with Anglo-American, Anglo-American music culture. And so for a long time, most German bands, rock bands, didn't sing in German. Now, there was a couple of exceptions, important exceptions. Tonstein Sherman was one. Kraftwerk was another. Udo Lindenberg. But generally speaking, German bands didn't sing in German. And so German punks started to, as part of their efforts at experimenting with music. And the initial wave of German punk albums, which came out at the very end of the 1970s and the very first years of the 1980s, these were incredibly important in influencing the next generation of popular music making in especially West Germany, and I think directly led to the Neue Deutsche Welle, which was this kind of German new wave genre of the early 1980s, which was enormously popular and essentially sort of roughly made it okay to sing in German. And so, you know, those fans and those audiences who, you know, kind of maybe missed punk because it was basically happening in one bar in one city for a few months. Who did experience the Neue Deutsche Welle later, could look back and see this as part of their tradition, this history. And so I think that what this mass appeal speaks to is how punk provides individuals with kind of alternative itineraries to the future. And that's why punk, even though only a very few people were involved with the production of the music and the fashion and the scene, could speak to a much broader audience.
Oh, yeah, thank you. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, can I pick up on this thread of singing German to go back a little bit to the German issue? Because, of course, the reason why German, the language, is problematic is because of National Socialism, right? And the image of German and the use of music by National Socialism. But the punks actually really used it, the really punks being punks, use it in a very productive way. And you open chapter one with this very productive account by Marilou Monroe, Franz Billmeyer, of his impression of the first concert he saw. I think it's The Clash and The Damned in 1977. And he said, and it was his quote, like he said that the concert was indescribable, an orgy. And not since the thousand-year Reich have people been so carried away. What does it quote say? What does it mean in this particular historical context? And really, also, if you want to talk, I want to talk a little bit more, not just about the connection to National Socialism, but also about the whole idea of a punk travelogue. And what does it tell us about the way youths in West Germany, East Germany, adapted to the sound of punk in this particular moment?
Yeah. Fascism, I think, is a kind of critical reference point for punk and, of course, for all of German history after 1945, that I don't think is particularly controversial. And punks, as you say, Ron, sort of engaged with fascism in very productive ways in a variety of different ways, I believe. There was, as I say in the book, this a tremendous amount of flirtation with fascism. And this is part of punk's sort of pursuit of provocation. On the one hand, people like Monroe, they used fascism to needle the alternative left and to provoke sort of outrageous responses from the 68ers, who of course were much more earnest, I guess, in their condemnations of fascism. But this provocation, it was always this very fine line, which someone like Monroe here, for example, embodies in this line in which he's sort of comparing the Clash concert to the sort of ecstatic experience of National Socialism. And there's a lot of this that runs through punk in the early years. And people were never quite 100% sure how serious or how unserious punks were with this flirtations. DAF, Deutsche Amerikanische Freundschaft, this is a really important band in the late 70s, early 1980s. They played with this kind of fascist aesthetic tremendously with a number of their songs, like Der Mussolini, which had all sorts of lyrics associating Hitler and Jesus together, which people were offended by. But at the same time, of course, their name, DAF, this is the acronym for the Nazi Labor Union. They dressed in this kind of Nazi chic leather, sweating muscles aesthetic. And so one was never quite sure how serious or how unserious punks were when it came to their flirtations with fascism. Probably, at least for me at anyways, the person who made the most sense in trying to figure out this conundrum was an artist, Moritz Ahr, who was a member of Der Plan. And he talked about how in the late 1970s that for him, and he said this multiple times in a lot of different ways, he said everything felt so unfree back then. And what he meant by this was that as a result of the sort of political dogma of the alternative left, of the 68ers and that generation, who condemned any sort of backsliding, conservative backsliding or something like that, that these strictures closed off experimentation. And so he has this funny quote that I quote in the book where he talks about, I can't remember the quote exactly, but he says something like, you know, if you said you liked high-rise apartment buildings or, I don't know, concrete parking lots, you were considered a fascist. You were considered a real reactionary. And he said he wanted freedom. And so he used fascism. He says at one point, the quote is something like, jokes about Jews were taboo. And so he used this flirtation as a means of achieving freedom. And these were, I think, important interventions at a time when fascism and the experience of National Socialism was just sort of coming into tremendous public discussion. The Holocaust miniseries had just occurred. And as Gabby Delgado Lopez, he was a singer for DAF, he said about the song De Mussolini, he said that that by associating Hitler with Jesus, that what the band was trying to do was to demystify, in essence, German history, and to make it safe for discussion. And so I think that this sort of intervention, public intervention about fascism engaged with by punk was an important part and basically as yet unnoticed part of German dealing with the past at this kind of critical moment in the late 70s, early 80s, when these discussions were appearing all over the place.
Yeah, 1978 is, of course, the moment where the Holocaust, the TV series showed, and that's where, so you have this rise in Holocaust consciousness, a very international rise of Holocaust consciousness and a rise of punk at the same time. And those are really, very interesting crossovers you have there. Another thing that I should point out, and Mahon, maybe you can elaborate more, is the fact that both Der Plan and the NDIF were very popular in Japan. Right, Mahon?
Yeah, they were certainly. They had planned to come tour Japan in 82, got cancelled, but their plan had been over and back to Japan quite a few times. And Japan also has its same kind of use of Nazi imagery in its punk music, maybe more, of course, copying the UK style of just using it for shock value, which I think is maybe one way of transfers to Germany. Maybe it ties into another question I'd like to ask as well, is because punk has this kind of very hyper-masculine image. I think that's where the kind of fascism aspect of it also plays into. But you write a lot of the social composition to punks, especially its gender aspect, which are quite thorny issues. And maybe you might make some comments on on gender in punk, which is something we're working on as well in our own work. Maybe the differences between gender and punk in the East German and West German cases might be a good way to analyze this gender aspect.
Yeah, a thorny issue for sure. I think that the first thing in trying to sort of sort this problematic out is certainly for me, I'm not sure how you guys are finding this in Japan, but certainly for me, when it comes to sort of elaborating the kind of social dimensions of the subculture, you immediately kind of run into the problem of having no sort of hard numbers about what it is that you are talking about. I used terms of sources. I used for the West, popular press was important. Lots of articles and comments about punk in various ways. Sometimes we get numbers in them, especially if some sort of event occurs in which people get arrested. And that kind of allows for some sort of rudimentary elaboration. And in the East, not a lot of newspaper commentary, but state files, especially from the secret police, that allows for some guesswork about the size and social composition of the Sum culture. But again, this is your kind of, in a certain way, you're held hostage to your sources. I have no idea how the secret police, the Stasi, counted punks. And so if they say there was 400 punks in Leipzig, I don't know what their methodology or criteria is for making that assessment, right? Was it, I don't know, hairstyle or something? But even then, this is sort of problematic. So in the first instance, when trying to sort of think about this, and I'd be interested to hear how you guys are sorting this out, is a lack of numbers. Having said all that, I do make some claims about the social composition of punk in Germany. On the one hand, it's certainly a lot more diverse, I would say, than the sort of stereotypical idea that punk is a kind of proletarian subculture, which, you know, is basically stems back from the 1970s social scientist work. And certain city scenes were much different from one another in Germany. And that's an important sort of element of German punk, is that Hamburg punk was much different from Dusseldorf punk, which was much different from West Berlin punk. And each of these city scenes kind of developed somewhat independently of themselves for a couple of years before around 1979, when a series of events sort of nationalize the subculture, and these different city scenes start to come into contact with one another and start to sort of sort out what is real punk. But we see in places like Dusseldorf, for example, this is a very middle-class scene. Lots of art students, lots of kids coming from the suburbs who come into Dusseldorf. And that's much different from, say, Hamburg, which is a lot more, I would say, working class. And in terms of gender, there's kind of a similar mappings in which the more middle class the scene, it seems there's more gender diversity. And the more diversity in a scene also seems to correlate to more experimentation when it comes to music. And so places like Dusseldorf and West Berlin, for example, they were probably the most experimental, and they were also, I think, the most diverse. And punk, on the one hand, while I think that there was tremendous sort of opportunities for women to become involved in a music industry, music culture, which until then was very masculine, dominated by men. I think that punk gave women a tremendous amount of opportunities, both in terms of sort of the content of you know, music making or organizing shows, playing instruments, songwriting, which is an incredibly important development here for German music industry, just in general. At the same time, it's just as in Britain, as America, as basically the world over, the punk subculture is overwhelmingly male. Even if, as the example of Monroe suggests, Franz Bielemeyer, he took his nom de guerre, Mary Lou Monroe. And as that name suggests, there was a considerable amount of fluidity when it came to sort of what it meant to be masculine in the punk subculture, right? So on the one hand, you had groups like DAF who were playing up this kind of hyper-masculine, almost to the point of parody. And on the other hand, you had tremendous amount of fluidity. So this isn't a very good answer, but this sort of punk was incredibly, I think, complex and naughty when it comes to sort of figuring out who was a part of it, what did the subculture look like, and then especially flowing from that is sort of exploring the consequences of that. And I think that that's a super important, difficult task. And I think that as each sort of book on punk comes out, we get more or closer and closer, I would say, to sort of thinking about, thinking through these problems.
Yeah, if I can maybe just jump in, like answer a question about what we found, and maybe Mahoney can also jump in, because a lot of it got to do with the archives. You're perfectly, in Japan as well, the way that gender and class intersects are very important. And like we found, what you found about class, working class versus middle class punks, it, I think, correlates to what we found. We solved the problem of numbers by looking at one city, right? So it's much easier for us to estimate. But even that, it's really hard because of the nature of the archives, or the lack of archives, actually, that we have. Right. So in our case, we have an estimate of how many people were part of the scene, but it's really, really hard. Right, Mahon?
Yeah, we're talking small numbers as well. In a city of, what, 1 million people, we're talking about full-time punks, maybe 100, 200. That'd be a generous estimate.
How are you identifying them as punks?
This is the key question.
Well, it's based on self-identification.
Yeah. Yes, it is a key thing, yeah.
If they call themselves, and it's very fluid, and we talk about kids, right? Mostly, I mean young people who move between identities and musical scene, and specifically in our part, and I don't want to get too much into our work, but when you move from punk to new wave to noise, it's very fluid. So we need to keep our board
maybe
is fluid.
That's something that you bring out your book, Jeff, I think, as well, the life cycle of punks as well. I mean, for Kyoto, it seems like the punk band's a typical life cycle is 3 years maximum, and then there's either quit the band or do something different or leave the scene or move into some other purchasing. But you seem to show a bit more of a long-term game with the German punks, if that's the right word to use. They seem to be in it for the long haul.
Yeah, I think there's a certain segment or long haulers who are there for life, and then there's this constant rotation of younger people. Yeah.
Yeah, and jumping ahead, this actually relates to something that's very important for us also, and you already mentioned the 68. You mentioned 68ers as an enemy, quote-unquote, or as a rival. Maybe you can elaborate more on this. What role did the hippies played. They're very important in our research, but also I want to hear about your place of those people in your research.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, they are portrayed as enemies by punks. Although I think, as I show in my book, I think that we kind of want to question this a little bit. On the one hand, yeah, the punks, part of their sort of self-construction is to contrast themselves with the previous generation, the 60s generation, hippies, 68ers in Germany. And part of their sort of rebellion, in fact, I argue, isn't so much against society in general as it is against this particular generation, who in many ways are their sort of older brothers and sisters. Punks were too young, basically, to have experienced the late 60s, but they, of course, grew up in the shadow of the 60s. And so hippies are essentially a useful mirror in the construction of themselves, and they sort of reject basically everything that hippies supposedly stand for en route to the creation of their own identities and culture. At the same time, as I think I show, there's just a tremendous amount of continuity between this earlier generation and punks. And in a sort of strange and weird way, punks are, certainly in certain ways, not in every way, but in certain ways, are in some ways the sort of fulfillment of many of the goals of the 1960s, even if they sort of, you know, pursued those routes in different ways. I think the do-it-yourself activism and endeavor that is such an important part of punk culture, from, you know, the creation of media to music to clubs, etc. All of that has tremendous continuities with the 60s generation. And even just in general, the politics of punks in terms of the sort of creation of an acceptance of difference and alternativeness is an important continuity as well. And it's not just sort of the goals, I would say, that speak to this longstanding traditions, but also in many cases, personnel. There was a number of individuals who were active in the late 60s or early 70s who would be, you know, consider themselves, or who did consider themselves as part of the alternative milieu, the alternative left, which punks were ostensibly against, who continued their work with punk. Probably the foremost figure here is a man named Alfred Hilsberg, who was incredibly important journalist, concert organizer, a label boss, who put out hundreds of punk albums with his Zigzag record label, and who also wrote incredibly important magazine articles for the main German music magazine, Sounds, which sort of spoke to this national punk subculture as a way of developing a kind of authentic German popular culture for the first time. And through his concert organization, he staged a whole series of national concerts, festivals in 1979, which really sort of is what brought the different city scenes together for the first time. And he, you know, he had been involved with krautrock back in the late 60s, and was, you know, a hippie basically, and saw in punk a continuation of what he said at one point was the sort of fulfillment of what Germans had missed with Elvis and the Beatles, basically that punk was the opportunity to create this national culture. And so he sort of continued this in with his punk endeavors, and still continues to this day. He still runs his record labels and puts out experimental music 50 years later.
Right, that's a great point to come in on then. And talk about kind of creating a German national culture. But of course, you're talking about a divided Germany in your book. And in chapters 4 and 5, I think you discuss these challenges faced by the punks on either side of the East-West divide. And quite surprising how the Federal Republic was quite repressive of punks. It was something that came to me as being unexpected, I think. Obviously, can you expect the repression to be there in the GDR? But can you tell us a little bit about this differences and similarities between the punks scenes in both parts of Eastern of both parts of the of Germany, basically?
Yeah, I had I expected to find significant differences, as you said, Mohan. I thought that sort of going into this, I would find certain things in on one side and certain things on the other. And so I was surprised at all of the kind of similarities in the ways in which punk, I guess, resonated in both societies and the solutions to punk that emerged in both East and West. As you said, we see, I think, oppression on both sides, or at least misunderstandings, maybe. In East Germany, punks, the East German state at first didn't really know what to do with punk. For a couple of years, it kind of insisted, state officials insisted that punk didn't exist in East Germany. But by about kind of 82, 83, punks had become quite public. They were staging concerts. They were giving interviews in the West to Western newspapers. And so at this point, the state government, secret police, came down hard on the subculture and basically, shattered the kind of first generation of East German punks. And so that was a bit expected. But in the West, kind of a sort of, not exactly the same, but a similar result occurred as well, is that as punk, or at least one wing of punk, became a lot more harder, a lot more violence prone, this group came into a tremendous amount of conflict with state and society. And we find a lot of sort of explosive moments between kind of police and state officials and punks. So punk gathering in public spaces become very contested, in which we have, basically business owners, convincing city governments to pass ordinances to eject these youths from public spaces because it's, disrupting their business. We see efforts by German police to arrest and to monitor punk concerts. And this kind of, this evidence is spotty because these files in the archives are just being released right now. So, what I was able to find was surprising at the amount of interest police and state authorities in West Germany took over punk. And I think that we're going to find a whole lot more of that as more information comes out. And at the same time, we see a tremendous amount of similarities with the ways in which punk becomes co-opted. In both East and West, although in different ways. In the West, this is mostly done through the music industry. After the kind of initial run of punk album subculture and these sort of originals kind of wrap themselves up kind of around 81 or so, 82, the second wave of popular German artists who became part of the Neue Deutsche Welle, the music industry went to town with them and were able to essentially mainstream what had once been punk and sort of by the end, kind of, you know, 84, 85, had become its own sort of genre, this new German wave. And so we see that happening in the West. And in the East, this co-optation involves the state, in which the state sort of by about 1986 decides that its coercive policies vis-a-vis punk weren't working, that in fact it was only making punk more popular, especially as punks were becoming integrated into the Protestant churches. And so they do this reversal, and they start to at first tentatively sort of support punk on the radio, and then full-fledgedly in 1988, and start recording punk bands, etc. And this, of course, required all sorts of, certainly what people at the time called compromises, and hard questions about being involved in a dictatorial state, right? Can you critique it while at the same time playing in, you know, state youth houses, even getting a salary, state salary, if you were involved in the state music industry? And so what these kind of similarities and differences speak to, I think, is that punk is, at least for Germany, seems to be less a critique of a specific political ideology or, you know, economics or society, perhaps, than a sort of civilizational critique or a critique of modernity in its various ways, which manifests themselves on both sides of the Iron Curtain. And I think that that's kind of pretty interesting sort of conclusion to come to from this comparison.
Wonderful, thank you. And you bring us some interesting things, fascinating things in the book that I encourage people who are listening to go and get a copy. The discussion between the alliance between the punks in East Germany and the Protestant churches makes for fascinating reading. But we'll move on to Ran. You've got a question you want to ask, so I'll leave you ask the next one.
Yeah, it's like the when you get to punk, I mean, it's a question that we dealt with since we were kids. Authenticity, right? I mean, what makes a punk, and who's a sellout? Because this is again a question as old as punk itself, which was for many people it was dead by 78. For others, it continued on, and you can see it play all both in East and West. I mean, when you start having shows in churches, I mean. Right, it's like, and then having shows sponsored by the Communist Party, you know, how authentic you are, and like you see it, I think in the West, I guess it's a much more important, well, correct me if I'm wrong, much more important discussion when you saw the rifts between the original punks and the new wave, and then the hardcore versus Kunstpunk or fun punk. Was it really more important in the West and the East, and what role does it play? Because this is a big issue that we punks deal with in our research as well. The issue of what's authentic punk, what's authenticity, who's a sellout, and the like.
Yeah, I think I don't know if it was more important, but it was more commented upon and more discussed. And that's simply a question of sources. Is that we're so reliant. When it comes to East Germany, we're so reliant on what other people were writing about punks that there isn't the same kind of dialogue which we get in the West. So I don't know if it was more important in West than East, but certainly people were talking about it more in the West. As you say, Rad, this is a huge, of course, topic, endless topic, if you will, in music more generally. Is a question of authenticity and certainly in some ways is the defining question when it comes to punk. And I, you know, I don't really try to solve it or anything, so much as I try to sort of point to the ways in which people talked about it throughout the book. And a couple of sort of interesting things, I guess, emerged from me kind of thinking about authenticity and the ways in which it's deployed in debates about punk, and the ways in which sort of East and West wrestle with this issue. On the one hand, you know, authenticity is it's reliant on experts. It's reliant on people who can speak to what is or isn't. And Rand, you asked a question a while ago about the travelogues, and these were an important sort of source of dissemination for punk early on. One of the things to remember is that for Germans in, like, say, 76, 77, punk, you couldn't experience punk unless you went to Britain. You basically couldn't hear it on the radio because nobody had recorded anything until late 77. And so you could just get these kind of snippets via text and images, which is a kind of really interesting way to think about the dissemination of music. And that probably is the same for you in Japan as well. And so there's this kind of lag in which music is constructed non-sonically. And so what that means is you're reliant on experts to tell you what is and isn't punk. And so for me, one of the really helpful ways of thinking about authenticity is that it's a regime of truth, a regime in which people, experts, are able to make decisions about, you know, practices or ideas or whatever, what counts and what doesn't. And you see this in all sorts of different ways, I could have, you know, endlessly written about this. But you had, for instance, you know, in fanzines, you would have, you know, these lists of, like, you know, this is correct punk leather jacket and this is an incorrect leather jacket. You know, you have to stand in a certain way. You have to smoke your cigarette in a certain way. All this kind of stuff in which people are sort of policing the boundaries of the subculture. And it's essentially an insolvable paradox of trying to sort of get at this, you know, eternal truth. And yet subcultures like punk spend just an extraordinary amount of time devoted to this paradox. And in the end, you're left with, if punk is about experimentation, if punk is about difference, if punk is about alternatives, you know, how far can you go before it's no longer punk? And this kind of, you know, as I say, this paradox just sits in punk constantly. And one of the things, though, that's interesting about authenticity as it played out in German punk scenes in East and West is that, you know, there's this constant awareness in the West, at least as it appears in the sources, fanzines and music articles and interviews and all this kind of stuff, at least in the West, it's there's this constant awareness that that punk is dead or dying or being lost. And this kind of, on the one hand, you know, urge to sort of engage in practices, et cetera, which can keep it alive while at the same time acknowledging that the moment has passed. And so there's this sort of, you know, pessimistic, optimistic, et cetera, swing that goes back and forth constantly. And in the East, as I said, we don't have, you know, we don't know the discussions that people had, unfortunately. You know, in a certain way, I kind of wish that the Stasi was a bit more effective and had been recording more conversations so that we might be able to retrieve these kinds of discussions. We don't know how Easterners debated this. But there's a really interesting quote by a guy who, he wrote a memoir recently about being a punk in Halle and growing up in the 1980s. And he has this really interesting quote, interesting for me at any rate, where he says, and I'm just kind of paraphrasing it here, he says something like, you know, we were persecuted, we were oppressed, we were jailed, but we were freer than everyone else. And that quote, for me, is probably the most important way of thinking about punk in East Germany, or at punk in a dictatorship more generally, is that, in fact, oppression and persecution made their experiences in a certain way more real. And it allowed them to stave off those sort of, I guess you could call them systematic or structural processes, music industry, for example, which were in other places, democratic places, part of the erasure of authenticity, of co-optation, of mainstreaming. And so I think that you could sort of make an argument, and I sort of tentatively do, although of course recognizing that authenticity is in many ways completely constructed, is that perhaps authenticity was experienced or felt by East German punks longer than West German punks.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And I recognize this. I had just a conversation last week in Tokyo with someone who's working with punks in Myanmar and in Indonesia, where there's oppression, state oppression. And yeah, there was almost envy at the fact that they have, quote unquote, a real struggle. And they're more real as punks. One thing that we're getting to an end, but one thing that also, if coming from Japan, like one thing that enabled the move away beyond punk in Japan, and I think that's what we see in R, is the fact, the example of German punk, actually, the fact that bands like Der Plan and DAF were more experimental, actually enabled, legitimized a move towards more experimental sorts of music, I think. Mohan, do you want to add something?
No, I think we've borrowed enough of Jeff's time at the moment. And I just to add that I think I fully recommend the book. It's fascinating to read, and it really added a lot to my own knowledge of what I thought I knew about German punk. I know a lot more now, and it's really excited me, and to works into my own research as well.
Yeah, before we end, Jeff, we want to ask, what's next for you? I mean, you finished the book. What are you working on now? What's your next research plan?
I'm not writing about punk anymore. I'm actually in Germany right now, for a year, doing research on my next project, which is a book. It's called Socialist Summits: Mountains and Mountaineering in the GDR. It's a book about the kind of role and the place of mountains in socialism. So it's I guess a much different project than punks, although there is a lot of kind of there's some similarities here as well in this kind of, I don't know if you guys know anything about mountain climbing and mountaineering, is that, you know, one of the sort of big motivations for climbing mountains is a lot, it's a lot of it's related to kind of individuality and kind of overcoming individual, you know, fears and you know, trying to achieve and all that kind of stuff. And that, of course, is this sort of pursuit of individuality was an important part of punk. And of course, is at least theoretically not supposed to exist under socialism. And so one of the sort of thread lines running from punk to this new study is this continued kind of engagement with thinking about individualism under socialism.
Yeah, there's a, I forgot the name of the article. There was someone who, I think it's a book you you reviewed, is someone who compare hiking movement in pre-World War Germany and punks. I forgot the name of the article, but I can definitely see the, I can see the parallels here. So, yeah, thank you, both of you. Thank you, Mahon, thank you, Jeff, for this really fascinating talk. We learned a lot. I was taking my notes furiously as you talked, Jeff. And I'm looking forward to reading the next book.
Great. Thank you guys so much.